This is RSBNB Update, episode 645, recorded Thursday, November 9th, 2017, The Revolution of Questing. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of RSBNB Update. The month of November is here, and I'm doing something a little bit different with the co-hosts this month. I'm surprising you guys. I'm going to be changing it up all throughout the month. So you're not going to be hearing someone consistent all through the month. You're going to hear someone different each and every week. So we're starting off this week with someone you guys have all heard before, someone who has been around for a long time and been around the RuneScape block for, many, many years. I think since RS Classic, but I'm belaboring the point right now. Trekkie is here this week. Welcome back to the podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to breathe.
It's great for dramatic effect. Thank you. So,
hey, guys. Yes, it's your fellow Asian.
Okay, I didn't think of introducing you that way, but if that's how you want to introduce yourself, that is perfectly fine with me here at RSBNB.
And I'm your
update.
Only Asian.
Oh no, I wouldn't say that. But
unless you want the Australian girl back,
we're not going to talk about that. And you guys might be wondering what that's about, but that is a topic for another day, I believe.
I don't think that will ever be a topic for another day. At any rate, hi guys, Trekkie here. What's up?
Yeah, I. Just to clarify, it's nothing bad. There's nothing that is going to be a huge revelation here that might be insinuated. Everything is A-OK. It's just something from the very early days of RSBNB.
Very early days.
Very early, yes.
It was before I was even a mod.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so this week we got the Revolution updates. They changed the way Revolution works to give people the ability to trigger thresholds and ultimates, as well as customize the number of slots that Revolution will activate for in the ability bar. You know, this is something that is essentially, if used incorrectly, giving the players enough rope to hang themselves with. Because what happens with this is you have the potential to completely mess up your rotations for whatever you're fighting. So you pretty much got to use this to a point where you know you're going to be using thresholds often, which takes it away, I think, and takes it away from, you know, bossing where you would want to use something like this down to something more like AFK Slayer. So did you give this a go and
So the other day I went to slay some abyssal demons. I said, all right, let's try it out. And, you know, you see, kind of something that I guess anyone would notice if we're trying it out is that you have a hard time using your thresholds because all your basic abilities recharge faster on the bar.
And the abyssal demons die so quick.
Yeah. So, well, it's not that. It's just the fact that all the abilities recharge so quickly. Their cooldowns are gone so quickly that all your thresholds and ultimates never really get used. So you do have to manipulate a little bit to around the bar toward the left so they can actually get used.
Yeah. Another thing with this is that it kind of shifts the way you need to think about ability bar positioning, because you might want to have a threshold activate, but if you're going to be having your basics recharge, rather than having that threshold at slot 6 or 7, you might take it down to spot 3. And, you know, this isn't of course optimal if you're doing standard combat in terms of having the abilities roll off the Revolution bar. But just because of timeouts, you're going to want to definitely consider having that be in the rotation. So,
okay.
Yeah, that was just a little mishap on my part. I pressed the Siri button on the Mac here.
I figured.
Yeah, we have Siri on Mac. It's not really useful. But anyways, So I think the use case of this falls squarely to Slayer. If you're fighting something that's more like a rune dragon or a bigger Slayer creature, you're probably not going to want to use this because those are more like mini boss creatures, essentially. Whereas if you're fighting Avisal demons or dark beasts, this works pretty good, I think.
Or are you just training combat in general?
Yeah. It worked really well at the dark beast, specifically using the bombardment threshold for ranged, because that gives you another AoE ability to aggro everything with and cause that damage early on. Assuming you can keep up Revolution north of 50%, or rather Adrenaline north of 50%, which is simple to do in that case. So overall, it's pretty usable. So
I like it. It's basically my way of, I want to be lazy now.
Yeah.
That works out for me. I'm lazy.
It would be really interesting, I think, to see what this does to DPS for combat and Slayer in general.
I don't think you're going to see much. I think if you really wanted to do that kind of thing, you would really want to go for full manual.
Yeah, and that's what they said with this, is that full manual will still, of course, be the ceiling. So
yeah, because full manual, you can actually activate, you know, their liabilities that feed off of each other.
Yeah.
But when you don't feel like doing all that, you're just like, all right, turn on Revolution, click something, and do something else.
Yeah, Netflix and skill, right? Or Netflix and kill, rather.
Okay. You want to go that way, Shane?
No, that's a term we've coined many, many times before on this podcast. Netflix and kill. So, they've also upped the floor damage given by both legacy combat and special attacks. So with this, legacy PVM combat has had its maximum, or rather minimum, hit up to 33% of its total damage potential, up from 0%, which, parsing that out, I think, unless the miss mechanic is entirely different, this means that you will have a chance to, not miss anymore and just do 33% more damage on the whole, considering you're knocking that lower third off of it. So there's that. Also, special attacks in Legacy and EOC have been buffed to shift 20% of random damage onto the existing damage floor, which, of course, just increases the amount of damage done in total. So I think it's a good day for lean-back combat in RuneScape. I personally don't know anyone who uses Legacy combat anymore, because the Legacy UI fixed most of those issues that were around that people were upset with.
And, you know, the sad part is, you know, when we first tried it, I think our little thing was more of, we tried full manual to kill stuff, and then we tried Legacy, and it's like the time difference to kill something was completely insignificant, which is kind of sad, because we were trying it. I think we were trying Revolution at the time, which was just released. Me, you, and Mike were all bossing at Bandos, remember that day?
Yeah.
And we're like, all right, let's try it. And then we try all three ways. And it's like, dude, Revolution or full manual was only faster by 3 seconds, which is, in the big scheme of things, means nothing.
Yeah. And I mean, at that point, we didn't have any of the bosses that, you know, required mitigating stuns or stunning the boss or provoking if you were running a threat tank. So that, of course, was something that we didn't anticipate then. And that has, of course, become a reason as to why you would use now full manual over legacy mode if you were out at doing a boss. So, and, you know, I think another reason we're seeing this is not, you know, not only to give legacy combat the footing it has in game, but also to kind of prepare for a bit of mobile, because you're going to have this mobile UI sitting on your phone and you're going to be out there killing Abyssal demons, for example. And if you enable legacy combat with that, you're going to be able to just slice right through them. And, you know, one of the great things we rely on with multi-way AoE combat these days is the ability to just lean back, pop an adrenaline potion, and away we go, right? So, and, you know, with mobile coming, legacy mode might become something you can do again, because you just put yourself into legacy mode and you just tap on each little creature and away you go, right? And it kills it. very quick.
If they're aggressive, it's even better, because if they're aggressive, you don't do anything. You literally stand there.
Yep. All right. I don't think there's much else to say regarding this, so we'll move on to our next portion here. There was a bit of a preemptive announcement here that the update for next week, Going Like Clockwork, was included in this week's news post. That's the Christmas warm-up event, another seasonal gathering event. So that was in this week's news post, but of course it didn't arrive. So, but
yeah, and that's why we're all picking apples.
That's right, in Farms of Treasure Hunter. But we'll talk about that in just a couple minutes.
Okay.
All right. So moving on, we got some patch notes this week. Definitely more than last week. The highest tier menagerie pet houses now have 30 slots, up from 25, which I think is something we can all be really thankful for here with this, because, well, let's be real. How many pets have been added to game? And with that, we want to store them in our house, but we might be running out of room.
Well, to be honest, I really don't care too much for the pets. I just ended up getting it. I was like, oh, okay. I wasn't trying to get it. I just ended up getting it. No. I threw it in my menagerie because, well, we'll just dump it here anyway, but I don't care for pets whatsoever. I got the Gramsci pet, I think it was.
Oh, yeah. And see, that's another different thing. Those are not necessarily pets that are going to go in the menagerie, because those are just cosmetic pets that you can summon with the base game interface. So,
oh, yeah.
We need to put our skilling pets in the menagerie. That would be a fun little thing to see them all bobbing around in there. So,
they're trying to eat up each other.
Yeah,
I can't remember. I think Ramsay is like a little mini troll or orc or something, or something ugly. It's like I can see it trying to grab the cat and cook it up or something.
Yeah. All right. Next up, Flameburst Defenders now provide the effects of a real defender. Of course, this is relating to the Dungeoneering update and the defenders in Daemonheim. So those will now provide all the benefits of a real defender, being able to use defensive abilities as well as having half the damage of a regular offhanded weapon. So
that's good.
Yeah. And you know, I think lots of people always overlook defenders because the defense abilities, you don't really need them unless you're at an NPC. So, but anyways.
I don't know. I think almost everyone is used two-handers or dual-wield. Just nobody really bothered with shields.
That's right. Definitely.
I think the only time people bother with shields is to just be able to heal after the boss fight, which is like, that's not the point.
Yeah, and then you put it on and, yeah, there's no use.
Heal yourself a little bit and then switch back to your main weapon.
Yep. Continuing on that, interface layout presets have been updated to better resize and handle tertiary interfaces, such as a Slayer counter for both standard and legacy mode, which makes sense because these were designed when RS3 came out, and they didn't exactly take into account that we would have a Slayer counter UI. So that's good to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And they did also update the RuneScape 3 and the old school UI a couple months back, so that they're actually a little bit more usable than they were before. So if you want to see what it's like to play RS without our own customized interface, you can pop one of those on. Though I'm trying to think of why you wouldn't customize your interface in RS, but yeah. All right, this kind of foreshadows what we're going to be talking about later on in the patch notes series here. XP lamps awarded for the Heroes Quest are no longer non-member items. So basically, if you get an XP lamp for completing the Hero Quest, you need to be a member to use that. So if you lose your membership status, you won't be able to claim that XP from that. And it makes sense why they would want to do that. That quest is something that is membership related. And if you lose your membership, you're not going to be able to complete that quest. So,
yeah, it's also the first member quest, too.
Yeah, one of the very first ones you can undertake. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it took... Let's see, it took, what, 15 years to finally finish the Elf City series? Well, probably not 15, because I didn't get it in 2000. It was what?
2001, what, three? And it was, 13, 14 years, give or take. So
yeah, So it's like it took them that long to finish the Plague City series.
All right. Sixth Age quests are now marked in the quest journal with similar messaging to Fifth Age quests, kind of like what we see when we would start one of those. And this raises an interesting point that I was thinking in regards to this next one here. Several, quote, agnostic quests have been recategorized as Fifth Age quests. Now,
okay.
I was always under the impression that anything that took place before the World Wakes was a Fifth Age quest. That was my operating impression.
Right, I remember. And basically during the quest, when they first were announcing it, is that once you finish it, you're in a new age kind of thing, and you're a superhero now and all that stuff.
Yeah, and that's why that was such a defining moment and why I thought everything before that was Fifth Age. But I guess it kind of makes sense to add in this new category of agnostic quests, because if you look at it, the Elemental Workshop isn't necessarily something that is going to fit into Fifth or Sixth. You can do that regardless of where you are. But, you know, Defender of Varrok, for example, that's a good Fifth Age quest compared to a Sixth Age quest. So I'm not sure how I feel about having quests that are just sitting in terms of being in any age. I much prefer the chronological sense, but maybe some of my fellow questers can reconcile that difference away if you guys are listening to this podcast here. So,
okay.
What do you think? Do you think that it would have been better to have just everything before the World Wakes be Fifth Age?
Well, you think about some of the smaller quests, like, you know, Gorgeous Cads,
Enlightened Journey.
Yeah, Enlightened Journey, Elemental Workshop. They're not technically part of any age.
Yeah,
they're just like it's a side quest, and it's up to you if you want to do them or not. You don't have to do it. It's just there.
Yeah.
I mean, what's it? Isn't it like Broken Home or something? Ashdale? What, mini tutorial island thing?
Yeah, the new Ashdale one. And see, the thing with that, I guess, is that if one of these quests did ultimately move into a line where it did influence the Sixth Age, it could move into the Fifth Age, and then you could have a Sixth Age follow-up to it if they wanted to do something like that. So.
Hmm.
All right, and with this, you can now categorize the quest list into Fifth and Sixth Age quests, which is something that was requested, and I think is a great idea. So,
you're in your new area?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
They also have added an accept interface to many quests, and there's just way too many to list here. So.
Okay.
All right, and then now this part of the quest update this week is kind of controversial, because what's ultimately happening with this is you have a number of quests here, and they have basically modified these quests so that they now award XP lamps rather than just giving out the reward XP, which on the surface of it is fine, right? Because, you know, there may be people that don't want to get attack XP, or there might be people who don't want constitution XP or strength XP. So on the surface of it, it's fine. Right, those are the ones I'm talking about. So it starts off fine, but then there's some caveats added later on. So it starts off with Goblin Diplomacy now awards a 200 XP crafting lamp. Vampire Slayer will now award an XP lamp for attack, giving 4825 attack XP, requiring level 10 attack to use. So this is something that did not exist before, is that if you do the Vampire Slayer quest now, you need to have level 10 attack in order to claim the XP reward or use the lamp, which, if you think about it, is Jagex as a way of saying, okay, we're going to have a look at these quests, and we don't want you to be able to, you know, just skip over large portions of a skill with these lamps. So Vampire Slayer, as it is right now, has no requirements to it, no level requirements, though you do need to be able to defeat a level 28 vampire for it. So, I mean, if you're doing Vampire Slayer, you'll probably have the level required to do it, but, you know, there could be a way of getting around that, defeating that, if you don't have level 10 attacks. So that's the trend we're going with here. Following from that, the Knight Sword Quest now awards a smithing XP lamp of 12,725 XP, which will require level 28 smithing to use. And you can see why they're doing it with this update right here. 12,725 smithing XP with 28 smithing. That's going to let you skip over a lot of the smithing skill. So what do you think of them forcing people into the camp of saying, you know, you need to train this before you can use this lamp and you can't skip over large portions of the skill?
Just looking at all the ones here, requirements are fairly low. Just breezing through it, 28 smithing, 50 strength, 50 defense, 11 cooking. It's not things that are going to take you like 10 years to get it.
Right.
And I'm thinking more for those like, oh, I just want to do get the quest to get some, if you're a member, get some treasure hunter keys. Fine, great, but you're a peer, but peers are almost outdated now anyway.
Yeah.
Unless you're a skill peer or something like that. But the XP lamp is fine. So be it. You want to make it 28, it's I get it, like if you're level one, but then again, if you're a level one smithing, how the hell are you can do Knight Sword Quest, get through all the mining and everything else.
Well,
that's
10 mining. Yeah, you would need that. And I mean, the idea, I guess, would be that you would get level 10 mining, and then after that, you would do this quest at level 1 or 2 smithing, and 12,000 smithing XP would put you over the edge and get you to level 28 smithing and beyond. Yeah, we get you to actually level 29 smithing if you were to do that, so... you can see why they don't want people skipping the lower third of the skill.
Which, in a way, that's what everyone kind of, almost
right. That's what everyone did back in the day.
Just do this one; it'll get you a ton. You'll skip like all the iron ones. You'll
exactly.
Skip all the bronze ones.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I see why they do that. They don't want people to be skipping this content because that content is something that is going to be played through a lot when the mining and smithing update comes out.
It's not overly high.
It's not. And see, I'm on the fence for this as to, like, from a game design standpoint, I can see why it's a good idea to have people play through the actual skill content. But on the other hand, the quest gives that much XP out, and 28 smithing's not a requirement.
Yeah, and part of it in the past was you did these quests, you can skip a ton of levels in the first place.
Exactly.
I can't remember some of the ones we used to do. The cooking quest, we did that level 2 or something just to get our cooking up with the cooks, with the Duke's dip birthday lunch and all that stuff. Was it shearing, making balls of wool just to get some crafting levels in, basically from level 1 to level 4. But come on, 28 is not that difficult. 50, that will take you a little bit of time. But the highest one here, 4 defense, 10 prayer. Yeah, you have to bury a ton of bones. So what? You're supposed to do that anyway.
Yeah. And see, I mean, if you split this another way and you get someone to sign up for membership, they do one treasure hunter keep a day and they get a large smithing lamp.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. So in that way, I mean, I don't see why they're doing it that way. If they're wanting people to play through the content. You see what I mean? There's still other ways to get the XP without doing the content, is what I'm saying here.
Well, I think it's also trying to get people to do quests, not just to skip a bunch of things, but actually do the quest for the quest.
Right.
But I do remember in the past I did some quests just to skip a couple levels. But then again,
but that would have been early on because you can only do that, below level 50, say. Maybe even 40. So.
Yeah. So, besides, you got access to Taverly in a way, so lots of things for you to do in that little area to train you up. Stock up on iron is always good to go.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure what to think. I guess we'll just ask the listeners out there. What do you guys think? That's something you can comment on this episode. Like I said, I'm on the fence. I think it's a good thing, good way to get people to play the game. But at the same time, there's other ways to get around it. So, anyways, moving on from that, other quests that have had their XP put behind Lamp's Dragon Slayer, which is 18k strength and defense XP, requiring level 50 strength and defense. Gertrude's Cat, 1525 cooking. Recruitment Drive, 3 Lamp's worth 1000 XP each for the prayer, herb, lore, and agility skills, requiring level 8. Soul's Bane awards 2 Lamp's worth 500 defense and constitution, requiring level 4 in defense and constitution. Priest in Peril, 1406 prayer XP in a Lamp, requiring 10 prayer. Nature Spirit is 3 Lamp's worth 3000 crafting and 2000 constitution and defense XP, requiring level 4 and 3 in those skills respectively. In Search of the Myrek, 5 XP Lamp's worth 600 XP in attack, strength, defense, constitution, and crafting skills, requiring level 4. Once again, another good one if you just want to experience the lore. In Aid of the Myrek, 4 XP Lamp's worth 2000 XP in those same skills, requiring level 12. And the Haunted Mine now awards a 22,000 XP Lamp, requiring 35 strength. And, you know, the fact that someone who might not want the XP and is just doing it for the lore can get it is good. So, but be interested to hear what more people think.
And, you know, just going to go through it, the highest one so far is, what, 50 strength and defense for Dragon Slayer?
Yeah.
I think almost everybody ended up getting at least 60 just to do it in the first place. 50. First of all, at least 50.
Right, because of level 50 to wear rune.
Yeah. But I think I remember back in the day, I trained to level 60. I think all of us kind of trained to, like, both of these were around the 60s before we actually attacked the dragon and whatnot. So that's the highest one, but you're supposed to get that in the first place. Unless there's some kind of peer, then you wouldn't care about it anyway.
Oh, those were the days training to the level 60 attack to get that dragon longsword. I remember it well.
I don't.
Every summoning scroll now has a tooltip of what the effect is. So that's good.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I was like,
yeah, useful. They added these. You think?
Some things, yes. If someone, let's see, the scroll, right?
Yeah, the scrolls. Because those have been updated here as well. The summoning scrolls.
That's a tool. Oh, that's in the skill itself, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
No. Like the ability skills for casting the Abyssal Strain, and that's one of the ones that was updated. Heals up to 50 prayer points, was previously 5. Stranger Plant and Swamp Titan now poisons for 200 damage, up from 20. Continuing on with that, the bats, the vampire bats heal now, heals the player for 50% of damage dealt, up from a fixed 100 life points. The bloated leech's scroll won't heal if the health is below 600, up from 60, and deals damage up from 10. You notice anything, specific here?
Hold on. I'm still trying to. Did we miss a page? No, we didn't.
No, I just picked and trimmed here.
Oh, it's only a couple.
But what I was noticing is that what we're having here is everything being multiplied by a factor of 10, which leads me to believe that perhaps these scrolls were not updated when EOC came out, because 5 prayer points really ain't that much today.
Yeah, that is true. I think the other little mini thing that I've kind of noticed too is we don't really have any like real good combat familiar right now, at least to my knowledge. I used to have the Minotaur just have it out with me just to attack some stuff, but usually not kill them so fast. Minotaur gets there like, oh, it's already dead.
Yeah, there's not much point.
And they don't have a lot of range or magic familiars out in the game that are like combat oriented. So I think that's something that you should really kind of look on. I think Jackass would do good to invigorate some of these. I used to, I remember training summoning and I made a ton of unicorns. I made a ton of minotaurs. because Minotaurs, well, I have to use these. I have a ton of Mithril bars from skilling and whatnot. I made them and I'll use them to fight. All right, I'm going to go train Slayer. Well, I don't have any familiar, but I'll well just bring you anyway because like, you can hit something. It didn't do much damage, but it felt nice having an ally with me. And they never die. That's the issue. They never die.
And you know what I think this speaks to a greater issue? This speaks to a greater issue of the game needing a summoning rework.
Which, and, you know, kind of like this way. If you ever go into the Slayer areas, nobody uses bunyips anymore, at least not the super high level.
Oh, no, of course not, because everyone heal with EOC.
Everyone uses a yak to hold more food or potions, and they don't have anything. They don't bring anything unless it's their avatar to get some more XP. And that's about it.
Yeah.
And pardon me, I really do think they should do something with summoning. I would love to have some familiars that would fight with me, but honestly, by the time they are ready to attack something, it's already dead.
Yep. And I mean, that just speaks to where summoning is right now. It's really the great pouch making skill. There's a few active familiars that are good. You know, everyone chooses the Beast of Burdens for combat, which makes sense. So, but.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's something we could talk about a long time, a way to rework the summoning skill. I think lots of us would like that.
I think one thing they should try to do, you know how like things like Granite Lobster, Magpies, and you know how much I love my Magpie.
Uh-huh.
We all kind of like take it out when we're fishing, especially in rock caverns and everything else. But the problem is we can't pay attention to the massive scrolling of tons of text through the chat box. And when it's about to die, usually I would miss it, or you know, we're AFK training, so of course most of the time we'll miss it. And everything drops to the floor, and it's like, oh, and if you're too late, it's all gone, which is a waste. So I think having them just all go to the bank or save up would be a nice touch too. Maybe, hey, do an invention thing where if you have this invention gear on, when your familiar disappears, all the stuff on it goes to your bank or just your inventory, depending on what you send it to.
Oh, that might be interesting.
To work with everything.
But that might be a little bit overpowered too.
Yeah, if you have the yaks and stuff, but it's only like if your familiar dies, not like if you die kind of thing.
All right. Well,
just a thought anyway.
Yeah, I think it's a good thought, and it's definitely something we need to think about going forward, how summoning could be tweaked and combat in general. Last patch note this week, it's no longer possible to consume the Great Gunkin when the player has more than the maximum number of life points.
What was that one again?
The Great Gunkin is made by combining Great White Shark with kelp. And you get the kelp from your aquarium. And the Great White Shark is a potential reward 50% of the time. From fishing once you have unlocked the appropriate prawn perks in your aquarium. So
made a 91 cooking by combining Great White Shark. Right.
Did we just teach you something about cooking that you didn't know?
Yeah. Okay. I remember that. I remember it about all. Whatever may have been released, and I just never bothered.
Okie dokes. Well then, we're going to briefly mention this week's Treasure Hunter promotion, and that's the Apple Jubilee. This is a farming and invention-based Treasure Hunter promo, which is something they really haven't done before here. So I found this really interesting. You can get, of course, the apples from Treasure Hunter, and then there's little mills that you can find around the RuneScape world. One of them is in Burthorpe, and when you use the apple on the mill, you can either pulp, chop, or mash the apples, and depending on what option you choose, you either get all invention XP, all farming XP, or a combination of both. Now, you might be thinking, okay, this is just another Treasure Hunter promo, but what makes this interesting? What makes it interesting is that they have also added in the ability to get protein cogs once again. And if you use the protein cogs on one of these apple mashers, or apple mills, as I guess they're called, you can get an extra 50% invention XP from it.
Yay!
So, I mean, that is the same amount of XP you get on a bonus XP weekend from doing invention with bonus XP and double XP enabled plus 50%. So,
and your clan avatar if you have it out.
Right. So if you have tons of cogs or tons of protein items that you're wanting to use as invention, this is the weekend to do it because you're going to get 50% XP, a 50% XP boost on however many you choose to do for this entire weekend. So if you have protein items and you're wanting to get some invention XP, just convert them all to cogs and use them because you'll get plus 50% XP, which is really nice for training invention. So just a bit of a notice out there to everyone.
Yeah, working for me, it's a work in progress.
Invention?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Not in Slayer.
Yeah. All right. So also this month, November started. So that, of course, means a month ahead article and updates coming this month. Mod Mark produced his annual, or rather not annual, monthly, his monthly video on this, and he talked about the various updates that were coming this month. So I would first of all just say everyone watch this video on YouTube and pay close attention to about the last 30 seconds of it. There's a really interesting thing that happens there, and I don't know if Jagex was trying to be funny with this or if they were trying to show off their own new studio, but there's a pair of people playing pool in the background, and there's some foul language that's used by Mod Mark at the end of it. Of course, it's bleeped, but it was a little bit odd to see in a behind-the-scenes video, so if you want to see something odd, just fast-forward to the last 30 seconds of this video to see the oddity in place here. But you guys are probably wondering what's happening this month in RuneScape, November-wise. So one of the biggest things they mentioned that's going to be coming out this month are combat pets for attack, strength, defense, constitution, prayer, and ranged. I don't know. I personally didn't think these combat skill pets were needed, but that's beside the point here. They're finally arriving, and these were decided upon by, of course, the player votes back this past summer. So there's that. Also, the next Evil Dave quest is arriving. It's called Evil Dave's Big Day Out. It is, quote, a retro-inspired novice quest. I think this is going to be really great because we've been waiting for a traditional quest to get back to traditional questing for a long time. And if the Evil Dave quest is the one to do it, then that's all the better. So
let's see. Retro-inspired novice quest focuses on ever-lovable Evil Dave. Fanboy has been busy working on a soul to grab hero's attention and plans to venture from his mom's basement, or as Reed would call it, an acne-ridden basement dweller, to spread evil across Illinois once and for all.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the fact they also say it's novice, which to me means that this is going to be one of those quests you can sit down, do, and complete in under 40 minutes, which, you know, I really do love the lore implications of the long quests that come to RuneScape. But sometimes, you know, you just want a quest that you can play over the span of an hour, have fun with it, and be done, right? So, but anyways... Also this month, some ninja updates for more tier 92 dieable armors, left-clicking options to add or remove from your POH, so you don't need to be constantly right-clicking if you want to delete items when you're building for XP. I think that's something we all have wanted for a long time. A long time.
Let me reread that part really quick.
Also... better luck messaging with your Luck of the Dwarves or Hazelmere's Ring. It'll tell you exactly what you got and how you got it. Also, transformation of more accomplishments into achievements. So this is telling me that, you know, you do something in RuneScape, you know, you get a 99 in the skill, or you get, you know, 120 in the skill, because that's an accomplishment, cape of accomplishment, you know. You end up with an achievement for that, which is going to be great. We also got the Advanced Gold Accumulator, which is going to be coming to a Dungeoneering reward shop near you for 1.5 million credits, which will pick up any gold that you get on the ground. People have been wanting that for a long time. And, of course, the Christmas warm-up event we talked about earlier.
Ooh, this is nice. You can also unlock the right to place it into your Slayer tool belt if you got the Slayer points. Oh, so just because of every single gold I get.
So you're gonna, right? And just imagine how much money you're gonna get from that. Because we don't like picking up, 8 GP here, 9 GP there, 1K GP there. So this will be good for anyone who does combat. So long overdue.
Yay. That's
Okie
good.
dokie. So we're gonna with that move on to our next update of the week, and that one is something that you guys have been talking about for a long time, and they showed off at RuneFest, and that is progress made thus far on RuneScape Mobile, which is something that we're all very happy with, and we all want to play that, I think, eh? RuneScape Mobile.
Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to it.
I think it was you who coined the idea that you'd be taking RuneScape and taking it to the bathroom for the first time or something like that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I don't know if I would personally do that, but I mean, I guess it's within the realm of possibility now.
Well,
So,
that's your fault, Shane.
anyways, what they did here is they showcased the mobile interface mockups that we saw at RuneFest, and they posted a couple weeks back the minimized and combat UIs. They also went through some of the optimizations that we were being told were being made for mobile, and they're making their way to RS3 as soon as they're ready. That includes FPS increases because of optimizations that are being made to the engine. And they said one of the most interesting things they heard at RuneFest was that, you got RuneScape running on this phone, and it's running more smoothly on this phone than it is on the gaming PCs over in the gaming tent, which I think is something a lot of people are going to be shocked about, is that the experience you're going to get for RuneScape on a phone is going to be great because mobile devices are held up to that standard. Whereas I know lots of people, even today, have troubles running NXT at 60 FPS, right? So it's going to be very interesting to see how it works on older devices, in particular with this. Something I am very happy about with this is a change they made to the ribbon. So the ribbon has been something that's been relatively static since EOC came out, right? Or since RS3 came out, And a while back, they gave the ability to basically customize it and add icons wherever you so desire to have them. But what they are doing with this is they are making the ribbon a regular window now, so it can be resized and reshaped to however you want it. So if you really wanted to, you could get the same kind of interface ribbon that you have in legacy mode at the bottom of your screen. And that's one thing they demoed on this video, the ability to make it a single row and increase its size. So that's really nice. I've been wanting to do that for a long, long time with
Why is
the
that?
ribbon. Well, there's really only two choices now. You can either have something that's four items across, right? Or you can have something that's flatter with eight items in it. But if you move it around, you're really at the mercy of a specific size, and it doesn't fit within one of the windows that I was wanting to set up. As my initial idea was to have the ribbon running along the vertical right-hand side of the display, but if you put it in its like that right now with its current position, it doesn't line up properly with any of the windows. So that's kind of annoying. So it's going to be great to be able to see this happening here.
That's good.
They're also adding the ability to target specific monsters in the game with a target bind, so you'd be able to focus on that target and not necessarily engage it, just like we have in all the other MMOs. You'll also be able to set up key binds to toggle between targets around you. They're currently working on the intelligence behind that to see what the logic is going to be for how we're targeting, but they do have it fairly working well. So that was good. And finally, a mobile user interface demo that they did here. And what they did with this is they killed the Queen Black Dragon on
Ooh.
stream here. So in about a 2-minute kill, It was
On the mobile?
On a mobile device, live on stream. Cool. They killed the Queen Black Dragon. So what you can see here, if you guys are listening to the audio, I'll describe it, is you have a revolution bar at the bottom of your screen, which will activate all of your basics and now thresholds if you so desire to have those there, right? So that's always going to be ticking down.
That's probably the main reason why they had updated revolution for this.
Exactly.
Too, because they know that it's hard for people to press the little tiny buttons on their phone.
Right. And what they did to get around that is they added a series of thumb buttons on the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the screen, and you'll be able to press individual buttons there and drag things there. You know, if you want to have your shark there, you can just press that button to eat a shark or to activate one of your prayers. So the idea behind this is that Revolution will do the majority of the work for you, but when it comes time to activate a specific threshold or maybe a specific defensive ability, eat or activate prayers, you'll just have to tap one thing with your fingers on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of it. And to prove what was going on here, they actually showed a picture of the screen updating live while it was happening on screen here, just to kind of prove that this was indeed the actual mobile UI. So overall, it's really impressive. I think the UI is pretty good. Obviously, with mobile, you know, you don't want to put too much stock into how it's looking, because once you get something on a phone, it's going to act differently than if you were just holding it, you know, with a keyboard and mouse. So we'll have to see once we get this in our hands, how it's going to turn out. So. But yeah, looking pretty good. They're still doing tests and whatnot. So for the record, this was a 2-minute and 4-second Queen Black Dragon kill on mobile.
That's pretty fast.
Yeah, it is. So, and you know, you can access everything else that you normally can when you're doing this, you know, combat interfaces, quests, items, and it's a fully featured version of RuneScape, and it's nice to see how they're progressing with this. So. Pretty good all in all.
Okay.
The full video of this mobile showcase will be linked in the show notes at update.rsbnb.com. If you want to have a look at it, they show some of the user interface changes that are being brought back to RS3 and also some of the changes that are actually happening on mobile. So we have a link to that on the show notes, the full show notes. Okay.
Alrighty.
Okay, now let's talk about something that might be a little bit difficult to talk about, or might be a little bit, I don't want to say rubbing salt in a wound, because that would be unfair, but this is something that I think we need to have a look at here. There's a tweet put out by Mod Orion, and he says, Shifting Tombs development screenshots. Of course, Shifting Tombs is the dynamically, procedurally generated adventure that takes place under Menafos. And he says, if we did anything similar in skilling gameplay to Shifting Tombs again, what would you like to see improved or changed? Obstacles, puzzles, random events, quality of life. So, what did we have for Shifting Tombs? Or what did we think of Shifting Tombs? What did you think of it initially?
If I was doing more slaying down there, I would probably do that more. I did it a couple times solo. I didn't do it with any group. Apparently, if you have a bigger group of, five, it would be a lot better, because everyone goes in different directions and can get more stuff accomplished. Everyone gets more loot.
Mm-hmm.
I did the obstacles. They were easy. They were, they were difficult. The puzzles, I will admit, some puzzles I had a little trouble with, so that took me a lot longer to figure out. Random events, quality of life. If any, I don't know. I think the Shifting Tune is basically an instance. Once you get in, everything's all generated, like kind of like Dungeoneering.
Right.
If I want to say, if you're going with a group, try and maybe do something like kind of like dungeoneering. You have something like normal mode and hard mode. Hard mode is the puzzles and whatnot may be more difficult to figure out, may take you longer, but the rewards are better if you can get far enough. But I did a couple times. If I do more slaying in the desert, I'll probably do those more, but my slaying limit is up there yet to slay those things. So, and you got to pay for each one you kill. So it's like, oh, that's kind of what Debbie Downer right now.
So, I think Manifos got a bit of an unfair assessment when it came out, and I don't mean unfair in the sense that it was flawless in terms of how it looked and how it was put together, right? But when it comes down to it, Manifos was burdensome for people who had already completed the majority of the game, because they were being asked to go back and step into mid-level content to raise a reputation system, which ultimately was linked to the completionist and trim requirements. So what I think Shifting Tombs should have been is Shifting Tombs should have been the fast way to gain reputation system in Manifos for people who have already done the majority of the game out there. And I don't mean so fast that it could have been done in, a day or two, right? I think keeping something time gated is a good thing to do, and it's healthy for the game sometimes to do. But on the other hand, when you have people with level 99 fishing going back to the game just to raise a reputation system for cosmetics, that's where it adds a bit of
Yeah, I didn't
little bit of
care
salt
for
in the
the
wound.
cosmetics.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't care for the cosmetics. You know me better than that. By now, I don't care for cosmetics. I was more annoyed that, oh, I'll put these into invention and break them apart, and there I get nothing but junk. It's like, oh, this is pointless. So everyone just drops it on the ground and just like, that's what's the point?
Yeah. So I think what we could have done and we could have seen for Shifting Tombs is that you have the primary Menaphos reputation track above ground, which deals with work in the various four quadrants of the city, right? So I think what Shifting Tombs could have been is Shifting Tombs could have been the logical successor to that, because everyone's complaint that I have talked to has been that the reputation system was useless aside from completing the quests. Because
I think you and I talked about it when it came out and I asked you how I get rep up. You told me, what's the point? Oh, you need that to get Fight Club. I was like, oh, that's the only reason I'm doing this. Okay, once I got Fight Club, I was like, all right, who cares anymore?
exactly. So I think what Shifting Tomb should have been, if Shifting Tomb should have been a less invested type of dungeoneering focused specifically on skilling with a little bit of combat thrown in. It should have been dungeoneering for the rest of the game without the lore. And on top of that, it could have provided, in place of dungeoneering tokens, more reputation than it did. And I think lots of people would have appreciated that who were gunning to complete the Menaphos reputation. I'm referring to the people who were, at the time Menaphos came out, already maxed and already comped and were trying to recover that. So I think what we should have had is we should have had an update that was like Dungeoneering, except tailored towards mid to high level content. And if you went in with a full group of five, you would effectively get rates that were similar to Dungeoneering. And I'm not saying that you should get, 100,000 reputation per run, just like you get 100,000 divination or dungeoneering XP when you're doing that skill. No, definitely not. What I'm saying is that you should get a comparable modifier to the reputation that you would get on the surface if you were completing these Shifting Tombs as a group better. And I think there should have been more emphasis on that, and there should have been more guiding people down to complete Shifting Tombs, because a week after Menaphos came out, Shifting Tombs was really quiet. So
Well,
it don't the it only stuck for, like a week.
I Yeah, I quite honest at the time, I didn't even bother with shifting tombs because I had no reason to do it.
Right, the XP rewards were too low. The reputation reward was too low.
Well, it wasn't that. It was the fact that I was more concerned about getting a reputation up so I can do a fight club.
Yeah,
and so I was working on it, and all I did was, and I tried shifting tombs after all of that, and I did it. I didn't think it was anything super special, and I just left it at that.
yeah, and I mean, don't get me wrong. I think the way Shifting Tombs came out was great, and that if you know what you're doing and if you set things up appropriately, it could have been a decent reputation grinder. I definitely get that, and I think that's great. But what I also think is that it should have been tailored more towards getting people to complete the reputation who are already maxed. And it should have been a fun thing to do. I don't know about you, but it didn't feel fun.
Yeah, like I said, it's maybe if I did it with a group, it may have been a better and different experience, but I didn't. I just did it by myself, did a couple of things, I was done.
All right. There's our thoughts on Shifting Tombs. This was, of course, tweeted by Mod Orion on Twitter. Some thoughts there, right? That so right there. So, I think in a nutshell, it should have been a better way of progressing through the reputation system than it was, because I know everyone who was working on reputation did the soul obelisks and fishing, which, I mean, is fine, but with a full team, Shifting Tombs would have been a better way to go, I think. So I don't
I
have the
think,
internal numbers to say what those would have been, but I think that would have been a great way to go.
yeah, shifting tombs. Either you still need to do that. You want to go slaying in the desert, dungeon, Slayer dungeon, because when you kill, it takes one off of you, unless you want to buy them all, which is plausible.
But Shifting
But
Tombs is separate from the Slayer dungeon. So.
you get the don't you? Isn't that the where you get the what you call it, feather thingy? As I remember, that's how you get it, the feather in order to pay in order to get in there.
Oh, maybe. Maybe.
Shifting tombs. Let me wiki that for you.
Because if
If I
that's the
remember.
case, that might have been a better way of going about it.
I remember reading it here. Feather. Yep, have a chance of getting of looting fetters of Mata while looting treasure chests.
Okay, so
I
there you
remember
go.
getting. So that's really the main reason why we would do Shifting Tomb is that you don't have to pay as much to get the feathers. You just do this a couple times, hopefully you get a decent amount. Yeah, I guess I do want to go back down there to the Slayer dungeon down there because a lot of good monsters to slay. I just need to figure out how to do a better way.
Yeah, sure. All right. Well, one final thing before we move on this week, and that is the drop rates for Virago, Corporeal Beast, the Giant Mole, and the King Black Dragon. So these are some definite legacy creatures right here. Virago is, of course, a huge task to take down, so people are definitely going to want to know what the drop chances are on this guy. So here we go. So for each person eligible for loot, they have a 4 out of 5 chance to obtain two tectonic energies. And of course, tectonic energies are what you use to create the power armor. So, and you know that's a good amount right there. So that's basically 80% chance you're going to get a tectonic energy. Virago came out in 2013, and if I recall, he was the first EOC boss. So, also with this, 1 out of 200 chance to obtain either a seismic wand or a seismic singularity in normal mode, and 1 out of 100 chance to obtain that same wand or singularity in hard mode. So it increases your chance by a lot there. I don't know if you would do hard mode for that extra chance, but 1 out of 200 is pretty rare, isn't it, for a tier 90 weapon?
Which monster was this one again?
Virago.
Viraga. Okay. Yeah, well, that's why they're considered expensive.
Following that, the Corporeal Beast has a 1 out of 5 12 chance to roll on the sigil drop table. These are pretty much just standard. 3 out of 5 12 to obtain a holy elixir, and 8 out of 5 12 chance to obtain a spirit shield. And of course, spirit shields were super expensive back in the day. So, really far back for that. If you roll on a sigil drop table, then it's 1/5 for divine and Elysian, 1/5 for arcane, and 2/5 chance for spectral. So the spectral sigils are actually more common than the other three, which is interesting, because when something like that comes out, you would think that they would all have the same chance, but no, they don't in this case. The spectral shield is the one, let's see, what does that one do? Spectral shield, what do you do? I used to remember what you did. Anyways, it's not important.
I did too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so 1 out of 512 to get a sigil drop, and
8 out of 512 for the actual shield. So they're pretty rare. And you know, tier 75 items, they're currently going for 1.4 mil, so
yeah, you remember how expensive they used to be.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was pointing out. Going back to 2010, it's always amazing to look back and see how these tier 75 items have dropped in price. So, Spectral Shield has the same defensive bonuses as the other Spirit Shields. It's the best non-degradable and third highest armor and life points of any shield. So that's still pretty good for 1.5 million GP. Highest prayer bonus. Unlike others, Spirit Shield, Spectral does not drain prayer points or reduce incoming damage, but instead has a life point bonus. So that's what that one does. Has a life point bonus. Neat. All right. Moving on to the giant mole. I don't know. The giant mole has always seemed like a bit of a joke creature, but it's a good start for bossing here.
It's like a mid level boss for people to have fun with.
Yeah,
I remember fighting it. It was easy. Have some food and just whack at it, and then you throw on a potion of energy, so you never stop running.
Yeah, and it can give a good amount of nests these days too, which is great. Regardless of difficulty, the giant mole has a 1 in 10 chance to roll on its rare drop table. However, whether you're fighting in hard mode or on a free-to-play world determines what rare loot you might get. Here are all four different mole tables. So first and foremost, the normal rare table for members is 1 out of 52 chance for a dragon two-hander, 5 out of 52 chance at the clingy mole, and 46 out of 52 chance at 3-6 numbing roots. If you're fighting in free-to-play, you still get the same chance for the clingy mole. You get a little bit better chance, 47 out of 52 at the 2-6 numbing roots. Now, if you're fighting hard mode, 2 out of 52 chance for the dragon two-hander, 10 out of 52 chance for the clingy mole, 10 out of 52 chance for the 8-12 numbing roots, and 30 out of 52 chances at a one-dose ultra growth potion. And of course, that is the one potion that allows you to skip growth phases in farming. So, people do it for that. If you were doing a farming skill a month, that is definitely something that you would want to use, because basically what this does, this potion allows you to basically skip growth phases in trees. So it doesn't work on spirit and elder trees. So. I'm going to look into those when it comes time to the next farming skill.
Save the best for last. King Black Dragon.
Yeah, the King Black Dragon. That's basically the most classic PVM instance out there, going back, way back. 10 out of 12, 80 chance for the KBD trophy head.
Yeah, get more heads.
Yeah, that's very funny, Trekkie. That's very funny.
Hey, only those who listen to us that long get that reference.
When Construction came out, that's a 0.78% chance of getting the KBD trophy head.
I have one. It's hanging on my wall.
Oh, good.
I wish I could hang more. Or was it the Abyssal Demon? I remember which.
All right. 1 out of 500 to roll on the unique drop table, where both the Dragon Ornament Kits and the Dragon Rider Boots and Gloves all have an equal chance to drop. 1 out of 5,000 chance to obtain a Draconic Visage.
Yeah, I was too bad no one uses shields anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, the Dragonfire Shield used to be rare, and it used to be a great thing to do. But you can, of course, stop all that now with potions, which I'm not sure how people feel about that. So, I don't know.
Okay.
Anyways, folks, that's it for RS news this week. We're going to move on to the questions right now. We got two of them. The first one is an audio question from Parnassius.
Hey, guys. Parnassius here. My question this week is in regard to something both Shane and Sirion said on the last show regarding the mining and smithing update. You both said you wish the T92 weapons players will be able to smith would be untradeable. Given that the main reason we want this update is to make non-combat skills profitable once again, I was curious as to why you want it like this. Isn't the whole purpose of restructuring skills is that we want it at least close to making reasonable GP per hour as combat does? Looking forward to your answers to this. As always, happy scaping to all.
Happy scaping to all.
Yeah. You weren't here last week, so I'll fill you in a bit on the discussion. And for anyone else who didn't listen to last week's episode, last week we talked about the design documents for mining and smithing. And some of the final equipment that you can get is the tier 92 weaponry and armor that you're going to be able to make with the smithing skill. And the way it's looking right now is that these items will not be tradable. And
okay.
I totally see where Parnassius is coming from on this. But at the end of the day, the thing that I like about the items not being tradable is that, you know, it does force people in order to train the skill if they want to be able to create that. And I see the issue at hand here. The issue at hand that I think has been identified is that you have an ecosystem as it is right now where it is reliant on PVM to generate weapons, armor, and thereby generate GP with that. And that's the way it is right now. But what I think the problem is with this is that, you know, we could make these and Jagex could make these all tradable at the end of the day for tier 92, and you get that and, you know, away you go, and you're going to sell these off and you're going to make lots of money with that. I think that would be great. But I think if you make it 100% tradable and someone just wants to focus purely on combat, there's not going to be – people aren't going to have as much of a reason to train smithing skill. So that's why I think it should be an exclusive reward for people who got all the way up to the high levels of smithing. So that's why I think that. But on the same hand, I also believe that there should be a way for people to make money with this new smithing skill. And from the design documents, what I can see, it looks like a good way of doing this would be selling intermediate components on the Grand Exchange. Which I think is the one that you were going to be able to purchase, if I remember correctly, as to how this went. So I still definitely want there to be a way to make money. But if it's not going to come earlier in the skill and if it's not going to come from intermediate components, I would be willing to have the items at the end of the day be tradable as well. Because, I mean, if you look back at the old days, that's how things were. And imagine if smithing got an exclusive weapon that only they could make with a special perk, right? So that's a question that I think lots of people, lots of skillers would be asking is, now I'm going to ask you this, Trekkie. If you got 92 smithing and you had the ability to make an exclusive item in game that can't be dropped, would you rather have the ability to sell that for lots of GP, or would you rather have to have other people train the smithing skill along the way to get that?
If it's unique, I say we should, what they should try and do is maybe do some kind of enchantment thing. Remember back in the old days that people used to say that if you trade, give me your sword, I can enchant it for you and all that fun stuff.
Trimming like armor,
yeah. You can do this. So it's kind of like what Gizmo and the Augments are kind of doing. kind of that kind of mythology is what I was thinking. You make the weapon unique to your own way. You need smithing or crafting or whatever it might be to do it.
So you think that should be the tradable one?
Trainable?
Or should the tradable one be the one before that and you get to make the final one?
Maybe they can do it. Well, maybe they can do something kind of like PlayerUnknown's Ports, where you have the one that you cannot trade be of gives more value, and the ones that you can trade for of lesser value.
You know, that would work, actually.
The stats are not as good.
Yeah, and so, you know, it could come down to stats. You're right.
And you know, an extra plus +5 can mean a lot for most people. You have a full armor of everything, and an extra plus +20 on all the armor can mean a difference between life and death. But you know, you have double swords, you increase them by plus +20 for each one, extra 40 attack power.
Yeah, and if you went something like that, you just need to look at ports right now and see how, you know, the untradeable scrimshaws are still great GP.
Yeah, the tradable ones took good money.
You're right. Sorry.
Yeah, the scrimshaws, great money. You make the superior ones for yourself so that you can actually use them and, you know, do stuff with it. But other than that, it's like, eh.
Yeah. But you know, don't get me wrong. I definitely want there to be a way to make money with the skill. And if it's either through intermediate items, like we were saying, or maybe a slightly inferior version that you can sell, I think that would be great. Of course, the only thing is I think it would still need to be at, you know, tier 80, tier 85. And I'd like to point out to everyone that if you make tradable items that sell for, you know, 1.5 to 3 million GP each at tier 80 to tier 85, that's going to be really good for invention as well. Because you can just disassemble them. So imagine being able to buy those and how much people would be buying those up. So, you know, the inferior way might be the best way to go, I think. But
yeah, make two of them. One tradable, one not. But the one that's not tradable has a lot more power.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, what you could do with that is you could even maybe split it apart so that to get to that, you don't necessarily need the inferior version. But if you didn't do an inferior version, you could sell the component, one of the main components of it, made with level 90 smithing to people who just wanted to do it. And that might be the way of making money as well. That would be another good way of accomplishing it. So I think at the end of the day, we want something, and I think Sirion's in this boat too, but I don't want to put words in his mouth, that we want something that you still can make money with the skill, but at the same time, we also want a way to encourage people to train up that skill. So,
okay.
All right. Thank you, Parnassius. You want to read the next one from Tycho?
Sure. Question from Tycho. With RS on mobile on its way, we have seen a number of changes to both free-to-play and game performance. Old code that have been left alone for decades have finally seen the light. My question for today are, 1, what is the most current outdated content in-game? And 2, what content would you like to see updated? It's going to be graphical, technical, small tweaks, or simple and minor detail that would enlighten your everyday RS experience. No reworks.
No reworks. We all want the hidden agility rework, of course.
What was the hidden agility rework?
Oh, just the fact that, you know, agility is kind of a useless skill right now.
Let you do all the shortcuts.
But why do you need shortcuts if you can lodestone places?
Sometimes you still gotta go through shortcuts for lodestone.
Alright.
If you do use a lodestone. A couple of places.
No. Current most outdated content in game. If I'm looking graphically at this, I have to say it's the area to the south of Ardoyan, through Yanil, down to the Ogre Hotel. Yeah,
Yano could use some love. It is the scene of the Wizard's Tower.
That entire area. If you put your game on lowest settings, you can effectively make it look like it was RuneScape 2 in 2004, based on how the buildings are there. So, because that place wasn't even updated for RSHD in 2008. So that's pretty outdated in terms of graphics. I also have to say Karamja is also pretty outdated in terms of graphics as well, especially the lighting and atmospheric effects. If you go into Shiloh Village, that's also there. So I think those are the two areas that stick out the most that are going to need a lot of work. So much so that if you go onto Karamja and you get off the boat, you can still see some of those trees that are as tall as your person back from the old days of RS2. So that is there still. How about you? What do you think is the most outdated content in game?
Oh, that's easy. Fix up Edgeville already. It's been what? How long has it been?
7 years, I believe, since Ritual of the Majorat came out. Let me just double check the date. I have to say it's 2010, but I want to be 100% sure. Ritual of the Majorat, you came out on, 2011. So it's been 6 years. 6 years.
6 years?
Yeah. So you're going to say fix up Edgeville?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why won't they fix up Edgeville by now?
It's a government project, that's why.
So, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people would like to fix up Edgeville and make it like a wilderness place to try it again.
I'm just gonna jump in right here and say why Jagex hasn't done that. They said it's gonna be hard to fix up Edgeville because it's easy to do a post and a pre-quest state of a place, which is what they did for Ritual of the Majorat, but having having three instances of that is hard, and you know it would be rather time consuming to implement that.
Well, look at it this way: I can kind of solve that in about two ways. So after you do the Dragonkin quest, where they basically burn Edgeville to the ground, because remember at the time they were thinking about burning Draenor Village, but more people were in were used Edgeville more, so they wanted to do more of an impact. Okay, fair enough. What you can do now is you remember what is it in Draenor Village, we had the wise old man was plotting something and we had the guy in the tree and all that stuff.
Yeah. That was for Wellgothic Sleeps, I believe.
Right. So one thing they could potentially do is after you finish the quest, there's a little cutscene thing now that you put into an incident of Edgeville, because I think you explore Edgeville, anyway. And then you're in an area, it's all desolate, you see how Edgeville is all torn up, blown up, and everything else. Then you leave the area or talk to someone, you finish the quest, oh, you're all done. And then you come back to the real world. Edgeville all fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And basically you have an NPC that just waved it off and says, oh yeah, the Bank of Varrock, after spending 10 years, finally fixed up the damn place.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically they could basically do like a flashback scene for the area or something. I don't know. Doesn't mean I would love if they fixed Edgeville.
Yeah,
just to put it, just to put it in perspective, in Guild Wars 2, there was a place called Lion's Arch, which was completely destroyed by a girl with a giant robotic army that literally destroyed one of the jewel cities of the land.
Mm-hmm.
Even they fixed it up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that took them less, I think that took them about a year, maybe a year and a half.
Yeah.
Because they had, and it's like, fix it up already.
Yeah. And, you know, they did that also in Star Trek Online. Remember that one episode where Species 8472 destroyed Earth's space dock? That was an anniversary episode. And they use that as an occasion to graphically update Earth space dock.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, what they could have done that with Ritual of the Majorat, you know, I don't know if there was a need to leave Edgeville burned like that. Maybe there might be something in the lore that I'm missing from one of the lore talks back then. I think there might be, but I'm not 100% sure.
Shane, it's been all 7 years.
Six.
Surely. Okay, it's been 6 years. Do you need an army of players to go in and with hammer and nail and planks to fix up the city?
I don't know. Maybe it's going to go on a 7-year cycle. It'll be 7 years since it's been done. Maybe next year. So.
Uh-huh. The other thing I would like out of grouping system. You remember that one? The fact you're laughing also tells me that, yeah, no. Nobody has used it. The whole idea of it is
it was used for raids players. And that's it.
Yeah.
You know, and I forgot it existed until you mentioned it because I removed it from my interface.
Yeah. So think about it. I would like to have a grouping system. I mean, a grouping system for shifting tombs. That might be useful for me.
Or a grouping system for Castle Wars. You just click a button, you get thrown into a group, and wherever you are, you go to the Castle Wars instance world.
Yeah, and you know, I think you always say you want to do dungeoneering, but I think the two worlds or four main worlds are still works out for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have what's that? There was another one. Yeah, I mean, I will do shifting tombs to, you know, into the grouping system, just group a couple people on and just do it. All right, cool. It's not a hard thing. Whatever grouping system that they may put on. Actually, you know, one thing maybe it's just me, but I would love it if RS didn't do instance world stuff. For quests,
yeah.
For new quests.
They said they want to get away from that, especially on the skilling side. I don't know if they want to get away from it on the quests. But they said something like the Arc Islands are a definite no-no again. Yeah,
That's one thing I don't like about the Arc Island. I think they can do some quality of life. It's nice to get all the stuff there. But the problem is, when I was there for days in real life. To get every little thing.
Yeah. And it kind of feels like you're exiled.
And I got a lot of stuff out of it. It was cool. I got a lot of stuff out of it. But I have not really explored that area, like, at all. So many stuff I should explore, but I haven't. And it kind of bums me out a bit, because it's like, there's so much stuff I could potentially do, but I don't do it because I'm by myself. And no. It's just, yeah. Especially on islands where you get stuff to collect and everything else. Like I said, I was there for days in real life. I would log on at night, go on it, and you know you have to do all the stuff, and literally it would take me forever to you know get all the turtles, get all the berries and all that stuff. And turtle ones, oh, they took forever to hunt. And the stuff would break. And those traps would potentially break, too.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it just... And so, if you leave, you don't get back to go back there and, like, finish up. You just lose it completely unless it's the one that you put a flag on. Even then, you're trying to start all over again.
So annoying. If you had to choose one of these pieces of content to be updated and modernized, what would it be?
Only one. I do grouping system. I think that's more beneficial for a lot more people.
All right. You're going to go with the grouping system.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? Maybe you can set a group and like, hey, I found an island. Help me gather stuff. And everyone goes over there. Everyone gets a share of the bounty.
Yeah. All right.
It's not a bad idea. I would love that.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say something that's already out there, but I want to see done with conviction, with confidence and with pride, I want to see done the mining and smithing rework. I want to see that done, and I want it to be done. That's a rework. Sorry. I forgot that point. Sorry.
Thanks, May.
Not funny.
It is for those who get the reference.
I would personally graphically update Karamja.
Karamja? Okay.
Yeah.
I go with that.
Just because, you know, that hasn't been updated since RS2 came out, except for the Brimhaven dungeon. So I would graphically, and the Tazara dungeon.
Hey, that's what you realize that we still never got paid for cleaning up the back room of that store.
Right. Right.
Then again, we couldn't clean up the back anyway. So,
all right.
We walked in, stole our rum, and left. Okay.
Thank you, Tycho. And if you guys want to send questions in, like Tycho and Parnassius did, email questions@rsbnb.com, or you can call or text 571-57BNB, or you can leave us a direct message on Twitter, which is not burdened by the new 280 character limit on Twitter. You can send as much as you want in a direct message.
That's mean.
What?
Throwing Twitter in there like that.
Well, I mean, it's a way of sending questions, and that's just what we do. But, you know, we could talk about Twitter this week for tech news, but we're not. Twitter did increase their character limit to 280. I don't think there's much to say about that. But instead, what I want to talk about this week in tech news is Snapchat. And Snapchat continues to fall after they hit their revenue targets. Their revenue this quarter was $207 million versus $236 million that was expected, and an earnings loss of 14 cents per share versus loss of 15 cents per share expected. And daily active users is 178 million versus 181 million expected. And the average revenue per user on Snapchat, if you use Snapchat, you're worth $1.17 compared to the expected of $1.30. So, of course, you can find Snapchat, Snap on the stock market. You know, that's a 16% drop after they announced their earnings this past Tuesday. And that results into a net loss of $443.2 million. And that's a lot when you think about it. Because Snapchat also wrote down $39.9 million as a result of losses from unsold Snap Spectacles, which was their first hardware. I was kind of scratching my head with that, weren't you? Like, Snapchat selling their own form of Snap Spectacles that you'd be able to see the world with. That seemed kind of bizarre, and as you can see here, $39 million lost because of that. So, the company also pulled in only 4.5 million new users, and that is much lower than the CEO was anticipating. And to make matters worse, Snapchat is losing market share to Instagram, especially since Instagram launched Instagram Stories in 2016, which is basically the same thing as Snapchat. So using a pre-built-in system there, it's safe to see why investors are rightfully concerned about the future of Snapchat. What do you think of Snapchat? Do you use it? Do you
hell no.
Up on any of this?
No.
I mean,
no.
And see, the thing we talked about when this came out is, how are you evaluating a company that shares pictures and messages between people and has them deleted at such a high value that it can lose $443 million? It just makes zero sense whatsoever. And considering Instagram is doing much the same thing without a revenue loss, and Instagram is actually gaining users. So there might be something.
Wasn't Instagram bought by Facebook? I think it was.
That's right. Instagram does have the power of Facebook behind it.
Yeah, so all the Facebook people are basically using Instagram when they're on Facebook and all that stuff.
Yeah, and but the good thing is that those two are decoupled, so you don't need to use them together.
Yeah, but it's kind of the idea if you wanted to do that. And, you know, Snapchat needs to, well, I don't know. It's all pictures of people eating lunch when they're like, why don't you just sit down and eat instead of taking pictures of it?
Yeah, and that might be a distinction between what you and I value compared to what the younger generation values.
I don't need to know the picture of your food.
Yeah. I don't know many people who like and use Snapchat, though. If you guys are out there in the audience, tell us what you do like about Snapchat, because, I mean, I don't
well,
get it.
Yeah, I'm not a foodie, so I don't bother taking pictures of food that I'm about to eat.
No, but the big question for Snapchat is, how long can they keep losing money like this, right? So that's going to be something definitely interesting to watch once the results start rolling around in January, February. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right, next piece of tech news is something related to what we talked about a couple of weeks ago in microtransactions. Ubisoft has generated itself to a position where its microtransactions have surpassed actual game sales in terms of actual revenue for the company. Their digital revenue this year is up 69% year over year, coming in at roughly $396 million US for the first two quarters combined. But when you start pulling back the numbers behind this, microtransactions was responsible for $202.6 million of this, making up 51% of total digital revenue for Ubisoft. And, you know, this is something that I think lots of people need to move towards a world of accepting, is that microtransactions have become the way to monetize games, even if they're not micro, for games that are wanting to adopt a free-to-play model, right? Granted, RuneScape has the subscription, and we talked about the numbers a few weeks ago in terms of how much money they're bringing in. RuneScape subscriptions are still obviously more, but you have games that are completely free-to-play. Star Trek Online, World of Tanks, similar things like that, where they have huge microtransactions. And, you know, with that, it's not a huge surprise that Ubisoft has reached this point.
Yeah, but keep in mind about those other games is that it may be free to play, and just microtransactions, it's basically pay to win if you really, really, really want to get the top tier stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Star Trek Online.
And that's what I highlighted. And that's what I highlighted in our discussion a few weeks ago about this, is that, you know, it could be a lot worse for Jagex and RuneScape if Jagex did want to go the way and getting tons of money out of it.
I mean, think about it. With Jagex, he has a couple mini boosts to get you going, and then the rest of it is mostly cosmetic. You get a new emote, new dance, new title, you know, things that you don't really need, but if you like it, you know, knock yourself out.
Exactly.
Let's see. What games have Ubisoft made? I know they've made Assassin's Creed. Anything more recent? I mean, that's the only thing I think of they're doing with the DLC is with microtransactions based on Assassin's Creed games.
They made
a Mario game?
I don't know.
That's what I'm seeing here.
They had a 57% year-over-year increase for this value. And two of its big releases during this period were focused on DLC. They were South Park the Fractured and, you're right, Assassin's Creed Origin.
Yeah, Assassin's Creed is their big money maker.
Yeah.
That's normal.
Yeah. The preceding game, Assassin's Creed Syndicate, only sold 15% digitally.
But they're basically cashing out on Assassin's Creed thing. And me and my friend were talking about it. It's like after Assassin's Creed 3, they're just like shoveling the same thing again and again. It's like no one cares about the plot twisting. Right, just let us go in and stab people.
That's basically the same thing Call of Duty does at this point.
Well, I still remember many, many moons ago that people were getting sick of World War II. And everyone was like, oh, it's all about Modern Warfare now. And then Modern Warfare came out, and now everybody went to futuristic. Like, everybody hates futuristic. Let's go back to retro. Let's go back to World War I. Oh, they're doing World War I. That means we have to do World War II. I thought we got sick of World War II. Why are we going back?
Yeah. Agree with that. But I think the upshot of all this is that microtransactions are here to stay. And for a huge company like Ubisoft to be providing 51% over their year-on-year revenue is a pretty big testament to the future of microtransactions and the way gaming is going to go. So let's just keep that in mind.
I mean,
that it's not going to be nearly that bad for Jagex in terms of their microtransactions.
Let's see. Well, this is completely outdated now, but I remember when Modern Warfare 2 was coming out. I remember they'd like, all the downloadable content you can get like right off the bat. Mm-hmm. Think of all the DLCs, they're going to have microtransactions. And I think someone did the math, like if you were to buy everything from the super mega night vision goggles and all that stuff, it would cost you like $1,000 plus. And I was like, you're buying all this stuff. You're basically telling them, yeah, this is a way to make more money.
Yeah, and we're kind of seeing the benefits of that now with Ubisoft.
I'm giving them more money, but it's like, it's... anyway. I just want expansions, not like a new pay for a new skin kind of thing. I don't care for skins.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Less is Overwatch.
All right, so our final... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just kind of thinking that if you ever do microtransactions for a game, my philosophy is it should not be impossible for you to get it if you grind or work or lucky enough to get it in the game without paying. If you are paying, it just makes things faster.
Yeah, and that's what we have that for I'm Star Trek with. Online, I think. So. Anyways, our next story relates to Microsoft, and Microsoft is planning to make more of its own video games, which is something they used to do. Microsoft partnered really close with Bungie for Halo 3 and whatnot, and then they bought the studio, and then they kind of disappeared with that. But this is in the news this week because Microsoft has announced and has launched now the Xbox One X, which, of course, is their 4K version of the console. So with this, they want to increase investment into developing their own in-house video games, which includes starting or acquiring studios to do this for the Xbox. Xbox chief Phil Spencer highlighted this in an interview last week. He also said it's also a complete 180 from how it was in the previous years, where Microsoft, of course, was pretty much acquiring deals with other studios and having them create the games. And, you know, some of Microsoft studio deals ultimately resulted in Microsoft shutting down studios, canceling games altogether, which led to a decrease in the amount of games and exclusives that we saw for the Xbox One X. Looking today, Phil Spencer says that we need to grow, and I look forward to doing that. Our ability to create content has to be one of our strengths. We haven't always invested at the same level. We've gone through ups and downs in investment. So as you can see here, it definitely looks like Microsoft is wanting to get their gaming franchise back on track. And, you know...
And they get some more revenue in if they do it.
Right. And the article rightly highlights that two of Microsoft's biggest sellers in the past have been games that they published themselves, including the Halo series and Gears of War.
Gears of War.
Yeah.
Actually, to be honest, I wouldn't mind if they finally make Gears of War 3 onto the PC. That would be nice.
No, that's still a console exclusive. Wow. I had no idea. I thought it was all out on PC now with the... Windows
no, so it's not. And it would be nice if they did, though. No. I think, and you know, if anybody wants to kind of think of that, Sony. I think Sony does. They have some of their own games that they create.
I
want to say Metal Gear Solid, but I think that might be completely wrong.
And you know, also with Sony, that their positioning as a being 100% dedicated to the games has also let them focus exclusively on games and getting those exclusives to the console, which people really like. So,
I mean, if you want to look at a gaming company that makes their own thing or is very successful, you don't have to go far. Just look at Nintendo with Pokemon and Mario.
There you go.
I mean, you don't mess with Zelda. You don't mess with Mario. You don't mess with, Metroid. I mean, literally, you know, if you're as a company, you take care of your mascot, they will take care of you.
And Microsoft doesn't really have a mascot, do they? Except for Master Chief.
I don't think Sony.
Master Chief. Actually,
Sony has Final Fantasy.
Final Fantasy.
Yeah, but well, Final Fantasy is made by Square, it's not made by Sony. But that's kind of always their exclusive. If you buy PlayStation, you always get Final Fantasy. But I never cared for Final Fantasy. It just took them way too damn long.
Yeah.
But for me, yeah, I mean, if Microsoft wants to go for it. My thing is, it's okay if your mascot, you know, flops once or twice. It's how you build them back up.
Yeah, that's fair. One more thing on this before we go. Microsoft is definitely increasing investment on the Xbox side of it because previously Phil Spencer, head of Xbox division, did not report directly to the CEO of Microsoft, Satya Nadella. But now Phil Spencer is on the senior leadership team at Microsoft, which means that gaming is going to be a renewed priority for Microsoft as well. So that's a little bit odd considering some of the stuff changes we saw with the Xbox as well. So definitely lots of stuff changing.
Well, they were
Microsoft.
They were trying to make Xbox and PlayStation more of like the entertainment system.
Yeah.
Well, you plug this in to watch Blu-ray, you do this, you can also set the TV, you can do Netflix and everything else. Nintendo just kind of went, screw it, this is a gaming console, deal with it.
Yeah, and I think Microsoft has finally struck the right balance with that, because, you know, for the long time, the Xbox was seen as primarily a home theater PC for all intents and purposes, but they have shifted back towards more gaming stuff now, which is good for that, so... But we'll have to see what the numbers look like for the One X when those come out, because that's a brand new $500 Xbox. So.
Yeah. Wait till the day when they make money off of selling the Xbox console itself. You've done good.
Yep. Took a while for the 360, but it'll eventually happen again.
Yeah, and you know, I think what they said was they were making so many Wiis at the time that everyone they sold, they made like $20.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not a lot, but if you think about it,
it all adds up.
Three million new users every month, $20 from 3 million, that's not bad.
Yeah, that's 60 million.
That's good revenue.
So,
and now we have to Switch.
Indeed.
I mean, Nintendo's basically like, it's a gaming console. If you want to do
it's quite obvious. It's a cartridge-based gaming console, which those apparently died out in the 90s, but they're back with the Switch, even though it's an SD card.
Well, you think about it too, Shane. They're introducing all the old consoles, like with this NES and a Super NES Classic. It's like, oh, this is so cool. I actually have a story to tell you later on about that. That's actually funny.
All right. Well, everyone, that's it for tech news. We're going to have a little look at skill of the month right now. It is the thieving skill of the month. We got Gemandy 52 in first place with 9.2 million XP gained. Flash is in second with 3.3 million. And Sunset Fish is in third with 1.4 million XP gained in thieving. Should also note that the RR Ron Man, the RR Man's Iron Man, has 366,000 thieving XP gained. Should be interesting to watch, see how this one shakes out.
Kind of plateaued right now for a day or so.
Sorry, what was that?
It's okay. Everybody kind of plateaued for a day or two.
Oh, yeah, true. I see.
They went flat.
Yeah.
But it should be fine. Still very early anyway, so go. Keep going.
Ooh, all righty.
Okay.
So we got some achievements this week. We got, starting on November 8th, we have PTV Spooky with 99 attack, Johto 3000 with 99 herblore, Spooky Ray with 99 farming on the 6th. Continuing on the 6th, we got Tor Elf with 99 runecrafting, and I Like Slayer with 99 agility. Congratulations.
We also have Tannis79 with 120 prayer on November 3rd. Tekis Fujigo. We got 99 Slayer November 3rd. The Pack, a 99 Invention on the 3rd. I Like Slayer again with 99 Runecrafting on the 3rd. And Elven Badass at 99 Smithing on the 2nd.
Good job,
congrats,
everyone.
All.
Nice to see that 120 prayer in there and all those 99s. Good to know that we're not living in a community full of maxed people. All right. Do you have a pick of the week this week, or shall I go right ahead?
Go for it.
All right. Nothing. So this is a game. It is in the category of free to play, but also has the ability to be that you can pay for it if you want. It's something that I recently checked out. It's something that came out a long time ago, but I wouldn't give it a try until one of the key factions was in place. And that game is World of Warships. It's made by the same people who make World of Tanks. It's a lot slower than World of Tanks. It's a lot more laid back. There's a lot less strategic thinking than is needed in World of Tanks. But basically what you have is you have a series of nations, the South Asian nations, Japan, Russia, Germany, the UK, and the US, all starting off with World War I era ships a little bit before, moving all the way to World War II ships and beyond. And you get to battle in huge open sea battles with everyone, and you get to basically choose your class of ship that you can play. There are destroyers, which are fast glass cannons with lots of guns and torpedoes. There's cruisers and light cruisers, which are standard run-of-the-mill ships, decent to moderate mobility, guns ranging on amount depending on the class. Then you have battleships, which are, of course, renowned for their broadsiding capability and huge guns on them. That's the line I'm going down, the British battleship line. And then you also have aircraft carriers, which are kind of like the World of Tanks artillery, where you launch planes remotely and you can use those planes then to attack other ships on the battlefield. So the reason I had a look at this is because, you know, initially the game launched with the German, Russian, Japanese, and American tech trees, and the British tech tree wasn't in place. And, you know, I just think that, you know, with the Brits being such a huge naval power, you really can't play something called World of Warships without the British involved, right? So that's why I waited until the British were in game to give it a go. You know, this game has a great tutorial system. It teaches you how to play from the very beginning based on all the game mechanics and the way the ships work and whatnot. And you don't get thrown into the whole game and the whole game interface right off the bat. You unlock various aspects of the game as you level up, and there's a little bit of a tutorial video each time you level up explaining the new feature of the game. So it's not as steep of a learning curve as something like World of Tanks if you tried that before. It also looks really great as well. I don't know how well it would run if you're running RuneScape and World of Warships at the same time, but it might be something worth trying, on the side. So, yeah, it's just a nice laid back, shooting kind of experience, not like Battleship, but more involved in that. So that's World of Warships.
Okay.
Available at worldofwarships.com and 100% free if you so desire it to be. So, and also lots of information on the website about the various classes and how they work and whatnot. So, all right. What have you been up to?
Well, you know what I went up to.
Well, what have you been up to on RS?
Well, why don't you go first?
Okay, I'll
Why don't you go first?
This week on RuneScape, I have been arc fishing still for training, invention. As you can tell, it's starting to get a little bit boring, arc fishing, but I figure that's the best way to go, right now for me. But in addition to that, I have been doing some Slayer tasks. I did a Slayer task of Dark Beasts and, Abyssal Demons, this week, because that's another way I am, training invention, is by running with an augmented weapon and an augmented set of armor and then just siphoning those off when they reach the appropriate level. So that's kind of fun, being able to set my own Slayer task with the Mask of Gloom for the Dark Beasts. So I do that. I also managed to get a Ganodermic mask so I can assign myself Ganodermic creatures, which was a long time coming, and I hear those are pretty good as well. I haven't done that yet, though, so... that might be a thing for this weekend. We'll have to wait and see. But that's about it on RS. How about you?
I actually did some slaying the other day just to try out Revolution, just to check out the bars, and like, yeah, I had to shift stuff around because it wasn't working well. I then also went, I managed to get 100 invention not too long ago.
Oh, very nice.
I think you announced I got 99 a couple weeks ago.
Yep.
And yeah, just been doing Slayer and Invention, just trying to get some stuff in. Play a little Porridge daily. And literally, personally, I just came back from BlizzCon, which was last week, which was a lot of fun.
Oh, what happened there? So,
I saw a lot of Maze.
Oh, gosh.
That's basically it.
Oh, gosh.
There were a lot of people dressed up as May.
And for anyone wondering, May is a character in Overwatch. So.
Yes.
All right. What was your favorite thing at BlizzCon?
I tried out the new hero that they're introducing. She's actually very different and, you know, more practiced with her. But I was watching I watched a little bit of the Overwatch tournament they were having, and I was watching the StarCraft tournament they were having there, the finals. We all know South Korea was going to win, which is kind of a matter of time and see how badly they'll kick our asses.
All right.
Yeah, but you know how, like, before Shane used to say, like, we all take it as a victory? If you take one win out of South Korea, I say that's a victory in itself.
Yeah, that's true. For anyone wondering, South Korea is very good at competitive gaming. So,
dude, they're crazy.
Yep.
They have no social life.
That's pretty funny.
Let's see. I think that was about it. Did I do anything else on RS? No, that's just Slayer. That's all I've done.
All righty. Well, I believe that finishes us then for this episode of RSBNB Update. Anything else before we go?
Keep on RuneScaping and go get those skills up.
Well then, if you want full show notes, you can find that at update.rsbnb.com. We're also on Twitter at RSBNB if you want to see what we're talking about midweek. If you want to chat with us in-game, chat with all the other people who are part of our community, that's in Friends Chat. Bits Bytes, and until then, we'll see you next week for another episode of RSBNB Update. Take care, everyone.
Bye, y'all.